Turn your Bibles with me, please, to 2 Samuel 15. I don't know how I'm going to act with paper up here, but such as it is. Occasionally you have one of those technology days. 2 Samuel chapter 15. History has been full of betrayals and rebellions. They've often been soldiers and servants who turn on their king. But we have begun to see that this rebellion is led by a son, a much loved, much idolized, much catered to, and not much confronted or challenged son. And in all his sin, and in the brief exile to which he was sent, Absalom has grown to despise his father. He's finally pled to return and is brought back to the city of Jerusalem. And you see his character in the final paragraph of chapter 14. Strike out at Joab and burn his field. That is going to come back later. You don't mess with Joab. And so we have the beginnings of the rebellion, and our narrator is beginning. He has shown us Absalom's character, and he's shown it through his conduct and his words. But now we're going to see not just that, but Absalom's craftiness. And so we would see as the story unfolds in the beginning of this rebellion. If you'll bring that up for me, John, it'll all come up at once. Thank you. The structure that the narrator has laid out for us that now leads us into this story. For Absalom has sought to end his exile, and he involved Joab, and he demands that he comes, and he directs his message, and then he ingratiates himself to the king. And so Absalom now seeks to end David's rule. And sort of abruptly, our author just says, and after this. So he's home. He's in Jerusalem. He's been accepted. He's back in the court. And now begins his conspiracy to become king. See that opening in verses 1 to 12. Absalom carefully executes his conspiracy to overthrow his father, the true anointed king. This is no in-the-moment unplanned. This is thought through. It is worked out. It has been plotted and planned probably during his exile. And now over 4+ years, it is going to be executed, this plan. The first step in this conspiracy is to develop a following in verses 1 to 6. Here's what the text says. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there's no man designated by the king to hear you. There's nobody here." Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were the judge in the land." Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice, except Joab. And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And Absalom did to all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Now, we're familiar with this kind of political scene. Here is a tall and handsome man who's putting himself up in front of people. He has the trappings of power and prestige. He's riding around in what his day would have been a Rolls Royce, or even better, a top-end BMW. And he's creating a kingly image, riding in his chariot with all to see, and 50 men running ahead of him with banners, and it's an entourage. And when he moves about the city, people will know if he can have their eyes, he will eventually gain their hearts. As one author said, quote, "Absalom understood the mystique of monarchy. He gave the people a glittering parade whenever he went out into public," end quote. And Absalom wins the hearts and the favor of the people by subverting the judicial decision of the king's appointed judges. He would meet people early in the morning who were waiting at the gate where the courts were held. They would have come from long distances, probably even spending the night outside the city, would have gathered early so that they can get an early decision and go back to their homes. But there's no one there. Not that early. Except Absalom. No judge or servant of the king, but Absalom is, and he would always side with the claim, telling the person what he would do if he were a judge, meaning if he could appoint the judges as king, he would be a better than what they have now, which apparently is kind of nothing. Why doesn't the king care? Why isn't the king paying attention? There's no judge here. Here you are with your suit and with your complaint. And here I have to be here as his son to tell you, I'm sorry, but if I were king, you'd be heard. And everything would be okay. And then when these people then would pay him homage, pay him respect, as the king's son, maybe even starting to think, wow, you know, he's going to pay attention to me. When he becomes king, maybe my thing will be heard and maybe I will win. And whenever the respect and reverence that would be due to him was to be given, he would almost respond to them in a way that says, no, I'm one of you. I'm with you. The response that he gives is that of just the ordinary people with one another, a hug and in the Jewish custom, a kiss on the cheeks. And his attentions drew out people's hearts to him. And so he won the people's love and loyalty. And he wins them away from his father. And he wins it to himself. And the second step in his conspiracy and his plot and his plan is to deceive the king. He's not going to be able to pull this off from inside Jerusalem. So this has been going on now. Verse 7, at the end of 4 years. So 4 years have transpired over this paragraph. 4 years of parading around the city. 4 years of subverting justice. 4 years of posturing in Jerusalem as the future king. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king. By the way, it is interesting in this narrative how Absalom is never referred to, that David is never referred to as his father. Because he's not rebelling against a father. He's rebelling against the king that God has placed on the throne. Then he said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I lived in Geshur and Aram," in other words, while I was in exile, "saying, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord." And the king said to him, "Go in peace." And so he rose and he went to Hebron. Absalom has a long habit of deceitful plotting, and now he has been plotting and politicking in Jerusalem for 4 years. He has plans now will take himself out of the city to work on winning the tribes. Remember, he's been meeting all these people who've come in. And now he's going to go out to Hebron. He's come to despise his father and what his father stands for, but he knows that King David loves and serves the Lord. So Absalom is putting a spiritual face on it. And he's doing so to win the favor of his father, the king. There's no indication anywhere in Scripture that Absalom made any such vow to the Lord. And frankly, why go to Hebron? The Ark of the Lord is in Jerusalem. The priests of the Lord are in Jerusalem. Hebron is where kings are anointed king. This is a lie to his father. He wants to go to Hebron where he will gather the people to rebel. One commentator, his name is Keddie, helpfully notes, quote, "We cannot assume that any such vow was made, for both the tenor of Absalom's character and the oh-so-convenient way in which this 7 or 8 year old vow fitted into his bid for the throne suggests it's merely a strategy rather than an exercise in personal piety." There's a side of me that says, boy, is that some understatement. There's no personal piety here. There's no desire to love and serve the king, to serve the Lord. And sadly, David doesn't appear to suspect anything. Now, if it had been going on for a month, we could kind of say, well, okay, 4 years. For 4 years, Absalom has been subverting the hearts of the people right under David's nose. David is blinded by his idolatrous love for his son. He has indulged Absalom over and over again. And now the pretense of spirituality totally fools him. How do we know? Because he says, go in peace. The third step in Absalom's betrayal and in his conspiracy is to declare himself king. In verses 10 through 12. So he has won the hearts of the people over 4 years. Now he has the permission of the king to go to Hebron. Beginning in verse 10. But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. And when Absalom went, 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests with Absalom, who went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests. And they went in their innocence and knew nothing. And while Absalom was offering the sacrifice, he sent for Abiathar the Gileadite, David's counselor from his city Gilo. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. So from Hebron, Absalom had prepared to declare himself a king. And he has a multi-pronged attack. First, he secretly stationed people in all the tribes to make the declaration at the right moment. This is not a surprise. He's been talking with these people as they've come with complaints and cases that weren't resolved. So in each of the tribal centers, Absalom places an envoy, a messenger, who will declare that Absalom was king in Hebron when the trumpets were sounded. So on a given signal, and at the same moment, all across the nation, Absalom would be proclaimed king in all the tribes in Hebron. So he has prepared the people, the nation, the tribes. Everything is ready. And when he went, he gathered 200 prominent people from Jerusalem to join him in Hebron. They were not part of the conspiracy because our author says that they did not know what was going on in their innocence. They went along with Absalom because He's going out. We'll just go with him. These are prominent families. But their presence is going to add legitimacy to his claim. They were pawn in Absalom's clever machinations. They were caught in a web. If they opposed Absalom, they risk retaliation. However, if they supported him, they would be guilty of treason. And they would be guilty of treason against the king and could be punished if the rebellion failed. Absalom has put them in a position that no matter what they did, David would assume that they were there in support of the rebellious Absalom. Clever. So now he has the tacit support of the prominent people in Jerusalem itself, and they don't even know it. And finally, Absalom offered sacrifices, once again pretending to have God's approval. And while he's offering this sacrifice, the idea here is he's just discovered the will of God for Ahithophel. And so he called it. So while he is fellowshipping with God over the sacrifice, oh, we'll call Ahithophel. Now you think for a moment that this is a spur-of-the-moment decision on either one of their parts. Not as the story unfolds. He summoned God's trusted counselor, Ahithophel. Ahithophel comes not under duress, but as one who has also betrayed his king. He appears in David's lament in Psalm 41:9. Even my close friend, in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted his heel against me. This betrayal foreshadowed the dark betrayal of Jesus, the true king. As a result, the conspiracy gained strength and increased in size. And now our narrator changes the scene. And he takes us away from Hebron and all of the evil that is unfolding there. And he takes us to the city of Jerusalem in verses 13 to 29. David is summoned. David is informed of the rising rebellion, and he prepares to flee from the city, and that he flees in the face of his son raises some questions about motivations. Is this the right thing to do? Is this the wise thing to do? Is he seeking to spare the city? Is he bowing to God's chastening and fleeing? Is this simply another evidence of David's weakness in regards to Absalom? Why doesn't he fight for what God has given him? He is God's anointed king. Absalom is a usurper in a rebellion. Why not muster his army and go out and take Absalom and the rebellious leadership? He doesn't have to wait for them to actually get to Jerusalem. He can meet them in the open fields on the way to Hebron. Or is this a wise and strategic retreat? Is he trading time for space? Is he trying to keep the fight against his son from becoming a siege of his beloved city? Is there a humbled and repentant submission to God's chastening from his providence? The temptation in this text is to focus primarily on David's flight and not see the emphasis of the author on David's interaction with people. But there is an image in the author's eye of David going down from Jerusalem. Remember, Jerusalem is on a mountain. It's on a hillside. And going down from Jerusalem and then going up the Mount of Olives. That for us who know the New Testament is so evocative. This same movement is evident in the gospel when Jesus leaves Jerusalem in the upper room and he goes down from Jerusalem and into the valley and goes up the Mount of Olives in the hours before his being arrested and crucified. First, our narrator shows us the humble servants around David. He is surrounded by wonderful and humble servants who are poised to do the king's will. Verse 13. And a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. And then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise, let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. I wonder how hard that was to admit. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. And the king's servants said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides. So the king went out and all his household after him. And the king left 10 concubines to keep his house. And the king went out and all the people after him. And they halted at the last house. These humble servants first who warned David. The messengers and servants bring news of the danger of the uprising. Because of Absalom's strategies, it appears that a large majority of the people support the rebellion. That's the way it looks. They want to warn him, but it seems they aren't necessarily advising flight. But David's response is to gather up his large household and prepare to leave the city. In his words, we hear his heart. First, he is afraid there will be no escape. He thinks of Jerusalem not as a place of refuge to defend, but as a place of entrapment to escape. And he is willing, and so he is willing to leave the city of God and allow it to be taken by the usurper. And secondly, he does not want the ruin of his household and the destruction of the people of the city. And I think this is commendable. He gathers up his household and all who would go with him to safety because in a war like this, all of his household is going to die. Absalom is going to replace them all with all of his own servants and all of his own followers. Anyone who stays loyal to David during this time is going to be subject to execution. And thirdly, he will need time to prepare his army. Who will be loyal? Who will go over to Absalom? Who can he trust at this point? And he leaves 10 concubines to care for the palace. They were to keep everything clean and in order. There was much to do. It was a large home. But this decision led to terrible trouble and a fulfilled prophecy. And so here are these humble servants who warn David, but who also go with David. And they prepare to depart from the city. This is no panic, disorderly flight. This is carefully ordered. It is a stately exit. They go in a column. They stop at the last house near the gate. And there is a sense of dramatic pause. It is almost as though all are looking back up the street to the palace and to the tabernacle. We will return. But waiting there at the last house, if you will, our author zooms the camera in on the passing parade to show us loyal followers. Verses 18 to 23. And all his servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites, and all the Peliathites, and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath, passed on before the king. And the king said to Ittai the Gittite, why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us? Since I know I go, I know not where. Go back. Take your brothers with you. And may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. But Ittai answered the king, as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be. And David said to Ittai, go then, pass on. So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. And all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by. And the king crossed the brook of Kidron. And all the people passed on toward the wilderness. Notice the loyal followers who commit to David in verses 18 to 20. Some of those who follow David are quite surprising. It's easy for us to pass over the ites here and not understand what is being said. The first two are part of his inner circle of foreign mercenaries. These two groups are not Israelites. They are Gentiles. They have taken up service in the king's army, and they are prepared to stand with him. The contrast is meant to be drawn. Here is his son who has rebelled, but here are Gentiles who now, not knowing whether or not they're going to get paid, but they are going to go with the king. That is even emphasized more with the 600 who are Gentiles who met and began to follow and serve David when he was in Gath fleeing from Saul. So these probably are Philistines. They are led by Ittai. They may have been Jewish proselytes because of the way Ittai swears, if you will, by as the Lord lives. That's something a Jew would say. But they had only arrived the day before. They are foreigners. They have been exiled from their homeland. I suspect that they heard of the threat against David and are here to serve and save the king. David offers them release to return to their city and their homes. I'm going out wandering. I don't know where. I will have no home. And you come to join up with the king, go home. There's another reason that David says this, and it's a little phrase. When they pass by, the 600 men, and did you notice it? They're little ones. These are not just soldiers on horseback. These are men with families. And so they commit to David. Now they go with David, verses 21 to 23. Like all the servants and soldiers who committed to the king, they will go out with the king. And a great affirmation of love and loyalty to David. These Gentiles, these possibly Philistine warriors, swear that they will serve the true and anointed king, whether it means life or death. There will be no comforts of home and peace. They will follow the king through the dangers and difficulties and maybe even death. And where the king goes, they will go. And they do. And all their little ones. Imagine. This is true love and loyalty to the true anointed king. Do we have such in our own hearts to Jesus? And then we are shown the submissive Levites in verses 24 to 29. I love the progression here. The first people that go by are the Gentiles, the foreigners, the aliens. And if you can't see that toward a New Testament projection, you need help. Here's the true king, the anointed king, fleeing from a betrayer. And Gentiles swear fealty and loyalty to the king with their life or death. So the Gentile soldiers who will serve the king pass by, and our narrator now brings up the Levites who there. Well, they have the Ark of the Covenant. Verses 24 to 29. And Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok came along with all the Levites bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of the Covenant until all the people had passed all out of the city. And the king said to Zadok, carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. But if he, the Lord, says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am, let him do to me what seems good to him. And the king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Meaning, are you not a prophet? Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until the word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. These submissive Levites bring the ark, verse 24. And here they are with all the Levites and the ark. They know who the true king is. The ark should go with the true king. There's no question in their mind of remaining behind. Absalom has no right to the visible presence of God, nor the holy service of the priests. But they hear his command in verses 25 through 27. But David is not going to do what Absalom has done. He is not going to take the ark with him and use it either as a talisman in battle or as an authentication that God is with him. See, I'm in the right here. I got the ark. The ark and the priest should stay in the city. But there is a role for Zadok and his sons. And so they return the ark in verses 28 and 29. David sends them back to serve the Lord with the ark, but he also sends them back to serve the king as informers. They will stay in the city with eyes and ears open, and they will ensure that any information, any intel that they can gather, they can bring to the river crossing at the edge of the wilderness. And he will ensure that either he or someone is there to receive that information. And so down the road into the last house and out through the gate, and the ark is headed back out, and they cross the river Kidron. And now our author shows us David's ascent to the Mount of Olives in verses 30 to 37. This evocative picture here points us once again to the evening in the last hours of Jesus' life. And it opens with the betrayal of Ahithophel, verses 30 to 31. And David went up to the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. God was dealing with David according to his word from Nathan. We see that promise of chastening unfolding here. Absalom was the evil from his own household. David had certainly contributed to the hatred and rebellion in Absalom's heart. But what explains Ahithophel's betrayal? Longtime friend, longtime counselor, had served David long. Why would he side with the rebellious son? Later, our author reminds us that Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather and Solomon's maternal great-grandfather, 2 Samuel 23. Did he secretly resent David's seduction of his granddaughter? Did he see Solomon as illegitimate? Whether we have real insight into heart motives, we do know that David saw the consequences and the chastening for his sin in all these troubles. He understood that behind it all was the sovereign, good, and wise God who was working to humble him and to bring him into deeper trust in the Lord. So David walks in humility, barefoot and weeping and clothes torn. He is bowed, but he is not broken. He is submissive to God, but ready to stand, if God wills, to defend the kingdom. And up the Mount of Olives he goes among his loyal servants and soldiers. And the news comes of Ahithophel's betrayal. David immediately turns to God and prays, asking God to turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And the answer comes almost immediately in the person of Hushai, verses 32 to 27. The narrator is clearly connecting David's prayer with Hushai. Notice this in verses 32 to 37. While David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. And David said to him, if you go with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king. As I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. And behold, their sons are with them there. Ahizamar, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you will send to me everything you hear. You got to love it. So Hushai, David's friend. Now you know what the narrator's doing? The narrator is telling the nation Hushai is no traitor. Hushai went and swore fealty to Absalom in the service of the true king. This is protecting the reputation and the name of Hushai. So the friend of David, Hushai, meets David in the summit of Olives, where the Olivet altar was located. He has come grieving for David and the situation. He will go with David, but no. David sort of humorously says, no, you'll be a burden to me. But not if you go back to the city. You have to see those two sentences together. So Hushai is to insinuate himself into Absalom's household as a mole. And the priests will be the conduit for what intel Hushai gleans. Oh, what a scene. Hushai arrives back at the city just as Absalom enters. And the picture the narrator draws is magnificent. There at the city gate, the son who is a traitor and the Gentile who is a loyal servant meet. And what will follow? The rest of the story. Just a couple of things. First, people who want to overthrow leadership often follow the same scheme as Absalom. Get people on your side. Deceitfully affirm loyalty and even spirituality. And finally, create an alternative leadership that ultimately removes the old. Oh, it's an old, old story. Goes back before the garden. Goes back all the way to the dark Lord who fell. And let me close with a psalm that has as its divinely inspired inscription a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Hear the song of David, Psalm 3. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill, Selah. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek and you break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. May your blessing be on your people. Selah, right at the center of that psalm. I lay down and slept, and I woke again, sustained by the Lord. Could you, in this kind of trial and difficulty, so rest and trust and pray, and yes, plan and work, so that in the evening and the night in which you are fleeing, you lay down, you sleep, and you wake up refreshed, sustained by the Lord. May God do that for us in Jesus. Father, we thank you. We thank you for your grace to us. We thank you for a story like this in which there's so much more, so much more to say and see. But Lord, I pray that we would have the kind of heart that David has here, to humbly accept the chastening that you are meting out, to care for other people in the midst of dire and great troubles, and to so rest in you, trusting that you will defend, that we can rest and sleep, sustained by you. Arise, O Lord, bring blessing to all your people.